rare insider's perspective on India's engagement with Russia and the world. Ambassador Pankaj Sarang, welcome to RT.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you.
You've been the ambassador to Russia from 2016 to 2018. And this is when Russia was under heavy Western sanctions. India-Russia ties also, some would say, were being tested at that time. When you arrived in Moscow, what was the mood like there?
Well, you know, the mood was very good because when I reached, it was just after Prime Minister Modi's visit to Moscow in December 2015. And he had an excellent summit meeting with President Putin. And the mandate given to us was to build the relationship and take it to newer heights. So as far as the bilateral is concerned, the mood was very positive. Within Russia, of course, you know, the sanctions actually began. There were some sanctions already in place after Crimea in 2014. But some of the other sanctions which came through the U.S. Congress began, such as CATSA and so on, began after 2016 through 2017. And they were pretty severe. I think the Russians were at that time trying to figure out what the implications are going to be because they were quite sweeping. So all that was going on. But from a bilateral point of view, I think, remember in 2014, Prime Minister Modi had just been elected. Although he knew President Putin from his earlier days as chief minister. But still, those were early days of, you know, kind of building a relationship between the two leaders. So that was very important. And then 2017, of course, we celebrated the 70th anniversary of our diplomatic ties. And that was, again, a big thing. So that was basically the mood. And the sanctions had not really begun to affect the common man in Russia. And I must say that I spend my time traveling huge amounts of Russia. In fact, you know, from Kaliningrad to Sakhalin, from Sakha-Yakutia right up to Astrakhan and even Chechnya. I think I was the first Indian ambassador to visit Chechnya. And then right across the Urals, on the east and the west, north, south. And you realize that why, you know, and what is the meaning of being the largest country on the planet?
Now, I know, Ambassador Sarang, that you speak fluent Russian. Здравствуйте.
Yeah, thank you. Спасибо. Спасибо.
Do you think that speaking Russian gave you an access into a version of Russia that most Western diplomats never really see?
Look, you know, Western diplomats, some of them, they also spoke fluent Russian. But I think, broadly speaking, I think our understanding of the culture and, of course, I would say our knowledge of the language was also very good. So, yeah, I mean, of course it helped if you could speak the language. And Indians were very well regarded. Basically, the default was if you're Indian, you're a friend. And then if you spoke the language, you sat and had dinner with them, had that, you know, proverbial vodka and all the rest of
lots
it.
Lots of vodka.
Lots of vodka. So you had to get into the culture. And that's true for any society in our profession.
You have said that for India, the primary strategic challenge is China, not Russia, and that India cannot afford to antagonize Moscow, given how close it has become to Beijing. What do you really mean?
We have a history of 70, 80 years, starting from the Soviet days, of friendship with Russia. The history with China is very different. I mean, it starts with the annexation of Tibet and then all the border problems with China for the last so many decades.
Yeah.
And Chinese military buildup on the Tibetan plateau, in the maritime domain, their cultivation of Pakistan as a tool to keep India under pressure and to use it as a front. So regardless of what the Chinese are saying, their actions do not match the words that they use.
Hmm.
Now, in this situation, it is quite obvious that between Russia and China, there is a fundamental difference as far as India is concerned. The adversary is China. So when you look at the Russia-China relationship, what we need to do is to maintain that friendship with Russia, because Russia has shown in the most difficult times, that it is willing to be a friend, more than a friend sometimes, help us in critical areas and bolster our capabilities. And so we need to keep that relationship intact. It's valuable for us. And as far as the Russia-China relationship is concerned, that's a sovereign Russian decision of wanting to build their relations with China. So it's in our interest to maintain our relationship with Russia in all the sectors which are of interest to us and make sure that their relationship with China is not influenced or does not have an impact on their relationship with us, that China does not exercise any veto on what Russia does with India. It's a complicated thing, but if you look at the some other examples in the world where Russia and China, although they are good friends, are actually pursuing very different trajectories when it comes to their respective relations, let us say with Europe or with the United States. China is completely integrated with the European economy, with the American economy. The Russians have been cut off. So here you have two good friends who have very different relationships with Europe and with America. So when it comes to India, Russia and China, it's important for us to maintain the India-Russia track, keep its integrity, and we don't want a situation where we do anything, take any actions which will contribute to driving Russia more into the Chinese arms.
Russia needs labor. India has surplus. The new agreement between the two countries on mobility of skilled workers, it's the most logical thing to do, but it didn't make the kind of headlines that, say, oil or defense does. But do you think that there's scope here and it could get big?
You know, sometimes all the wrong issues make the headlines. So when there's good news, there is no headline. When there's controversy, there is headline. Having said that, this to me is a big game changer in the relationship. It was always true, this complementarity, this mutual advantage. Not today. It's been true for the last 20, 30 years. But to be honest, a lot of it was not happening because of Russia's own reservations. Now, because of the situation Russia faces, there is more receptivity. So we used to tell them was that, look, there are 10 million Indians in the Gulf. There are 5 million Indians in the United States. There are hundreds and thousands of Indians in Europe. Wherever you look, whichever part of the world, starting from the highly skilled to the blue collar to the unskilled, Indians have shown that they can contribute to wealth generation in foreign countries. And we can do the same in Russia. Because of the war, there's a serious problem they're facing of shortage. The natural demographic process is very, very adverse to Russia. And this has been acknowledged by President Putin repeatedly in public pronouncements when he's actually said that his primary number one challenge for Russia is demography and the rise, falling population. Indians can actually play a huge role in the building or the rebuilding of Russia.
Beyond oil and defense, what sectors do you think will drive the India-Russia trade relationship in the next 5 or 10 years?
We started with diversification of the relationship beyond the traditional 3 or 4 strategic pillars, which was, as you said, I mean, defense, space, nuclear, technology, energy. So we started this energy relationship at a much higher scale, let's say in the last 10 years. But in the last 10 years, in terms of investments and in terms of not just purchase of oil, which is a post-2022 situation, but even prior to 2022, we were investing in energy assets in Russia. So now when we come to the present, to the contemporary, I think we are looking, for example, at other sectors like railways, fertilizers, inland waterways, shipbuilding, rare earths, critical minerals. And for all of this, we are in parallel developing alternative connectivity corridors to make the trade easier, quicker, cheaper. So there is a lot that is happening. Education, for example, is emerging again. It had fallen off after the Soviet period. But again, the number of Indian students going to Russia is steeply growing. And of course, you know, we have new frontiers of cooperation in the space sector. I think in the nuclear, as you know, the only foreign country which has a nuclear power plants in India are the Russians.
India is in BRICS. It's in SCO. It is in G20. It is in CORD. Some of these groupings are shared with the West and some without. Which of these groupings matters to India the most at the moment?
So what organization works for us is a function of the demands of the time. So when it comes to the BRICS, it's an affirmation or it's a reflection of the fact that countries want their voice heard. They want a world order in which they are no longer rule takers or supplicants, that they count and their voice needs to be heard. The Quad is a grouping which brings together four democracies in the Indo-Pacific region. It's developing its mechanisms. It goes up and down in terms of its personality, but yes, it has a role. So the SCO has its own logic, and we have to be there. We are there, thanks to the Russians. No thanks to the Chinese. But that's a Eurasian construction, which India is very much a part of. The G20, I mean, everyone's there. The Russians, the Chinese, us, the Americans, the Europeans, everyone. If you're looking at, let's say, your political interests, your security interests, your economic interests, your energy interests, each of these has a role to play.
India's hosting the BRICS presidency this year. With everything that's going on in the world currently, with the wars, etc., do you think that it's going to be a tough BRICS presidency for India?
It's always tough. I mean, we hosted the G20 in 2023, just 1 year after Ukraine. And everyone was saying it's going to be a disaster and, you know, it's going to be very tough. We pulled it off. We actually had a consensus document, which Indonesia couldn't manage. And so we got the Russians on one side. We had the Europeans in the other. We had the Chinese who were flitting between the two and playing their own games. And we had the Americans. And we actually managed to bring everyone in the room and got a consensus out, which was extraordinary diplomatic skill. As far as BRICS is concerned, at the moment, it used to be a homogeneous group. But even there, within BRICS, you know, there was always this reality of some of them being Security Council members, Russia, China, and some not being, Brazil, India, South Africa. So these three would always be very conscious of the fact that, you know, you have Russia and China on the one side. Not quite an equal playing field. Today, after the expansion 2 years ago, it's gone. It's really expanded. And now, of course, you have two BRICS members at war, the UAE and Iran. So we'll see. I don't, you know, the BRICS summit is still far away. There will be difficulties. We'll get over it. I'm not so pessimistic.
But I also want to talk to you about this whole idea and the Western media narrative that only if you have a consensus, only if you have a joint statement, a joint declaration, is then a presidency under a country successful. Otherwise, it's a failure.
More important for me is whether that grouping in the medium to long term is able to sustain, survive, and that its members still feel that it's worth being a member of that grouping.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether you have a piece of paper or not.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can have consensus on many things, which is the lowest common denominator, which means nothing. That's also of no use. So I agree that too much attention on this one point of whether you have a document or don't have a document or whether there are differences within BRICS. A lot of Western commentary, the default position is to say, you know, look, BRICS has so many problems. It is not homogeneous. You know, they're such different countries. But that's true of almost every international grouping. So that kind of commentary cannot be taken seriously.
The Western media calls India a fence-sitter, but India's made its position very clear. Strategic autonomy, national interest, energy security that comes first for its 1.4 billion people. But do you think that the fence-sitter label comes when India refuses to take dictations from the West?
You know, this fence-sitter, I think our foreign minister, external affairs minister, has answered this thing. It's a convenient colloquial phrase to use. I don't think we are sitting on any fence. I mean, we are playing the game. We are in the park, hitting the ball where it needs to be hit. We do what suits us. I mean, at one level, today, the world we live in, everyone is doing it, whether the Americans or the Iranians or the Canadians or the Germans or the French or the Russians or the Chinese. I mean, everyone's playing the game the way they want to, and pursuit of national interest seems to have become today the default position of all powers. The powerful get away with it because they are powerful. The weak don't, and they have to suffer it. But India has shown this record of maintaining its positions on core issues of interest, regardless of which government is in power.
Vladimir Putin and Narendra Modi, they've met some 17 times in the last decade or so. What do you think it is about their relationship of the two leaders that keeps India-Russia relationship the way it is, so stable?
One good element, or rather, let us say, one important element to explain why this relationship has been the way it has, is the tradition of having private conversations, or what we call one-on-one talks during summits, where, you know, they get time, a few hours, to just talk to each other about not just the bilateral relationship, but about the regional or the international situation. So there is a lot of frankness in the conversations. So honesty, transparency, convergence of interests, these are all the factors which are driving this relationship between the two men, which is a function also of the nations they represent.
Post-2022, after the war in Ukraine started, Russia became India's largest crude oil supplier in the world. But before that, the trade between the two countries, it stood at about $10 billion. That's really not a lot. Yeah. If the relationship between New Delhi and Moscow is in fact so special, then why is the economics so weak?
It is special despite the low level of trade. If trade is your metric of a good relationship, then we should actually be having excellent ties with China, right? So the beauty of the India-Russia relationship is the fact that despite this $10 billion trade, the relationship has not just survived, but it has done pretty well. So you have to ask yourself the question, why has the India-Russia relationship been so solid and strong and sustained over time, despite the fact that its economic base is pretty narrow? So that's the first part of the answer. The second part is the economic part. You know, it's clearly a function of the strength of the two economies. If the Russian economy displays internal depth and, resilience and dynamism, and there is mutual complementarity that develops, then this figure will go up. But it is a challenge. I mean, the lack of awareness among business people, the language barrier, the lack of familiarity with legal systems, lack of confidence in each other's stock markets or banking systems. So all that is part and parcel of this thing.
Russia and India, they've been pushing for a Chennai-Vladivostok maritime corridor, and these are meant to bypass some of the Western controlled choke points. How significant is this for India's long-term energy and trade security?
It's a very forward-looking project where you establish connectivity on the eastern seaboard of India and of Russia. So if you're looking tomorrow at much greater flows of energy, of raw material, of coal, of other sources, I would say even things like fresh water. Yeah. then this route becomes very important. And of course, it bypasses the Suez Canal, the Indian Ocean. But we need to work on it in terms of having minimum amount of freight, making it economically viable. But overall, I would say, given our own growth plans for the next, let's say, 20 years or 10 years, it's a very good idea because you need to diversify, develop alternatives to choke points, which we are discovering today. And then I think it's also, at the end of the day, will be linked to what's happening in the Arctic, the melting of the ice, the potential opening of the Arctic route for navigation, for trade, and so on.
Islamabad is mediating, or at least trying to mediate, between US and Iran. Why can't New Delhi or, say, BRICS not do it?
Why can't we? I don't know whether we want to. You know, Pakistan was created by the British and the West to leave behind a chunk of territory which could serve their purposes when they needed it. So today it's available to be used when required. And I think we are seeing that at full play today. India is not in that category. They find it both necessary and desirable and useful to play this kind of a role, because they're always in search of, using opportunities, maximizing them, earning rent, as one of my friends would say, geopolitical rent. And of course, at the end of the day, everything that they do is with one eye or with both eyes on India. Then how is it all going to help them when they need help of the Americans or the British or the West or maybe some of the Gulf states? So this is the Pakistani, my interpretation of what they're doing today.
Supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, he was assassinated by U.S.-Israeli strikes. Iran got a new supreme leader, a new Khamenei. What did the U.S. achieve?
So I'm not sure what kind of a regime change the Americans have achieved. In fact, the common wisdom is that the new regime, as it will develop in the coming period, is likely to be even more hardline than the previous. There will definitely be that sense among big sections of them of seeking revenge or of asserting Iran's sovereignty.
You were India's High Commissioner to Bangladesh. Since Hasina left, things have been a bit rough. Now there is a BNP running Bangladesh, and very recently in the Indian state of Bengal, the Bharatiya Janata Party has won the elections. So both sides of the border, there's a new government. How do you view these developments?
No, one is a state government, one is a sovereign national government.
But the Bangladesh government is very closely watching or was watching the elections in West Bengal.
Yeah, sure. I mean, they always do. I mean, they've lived with West Bengal, I mean, ever since they were created. So I would say that if you have the same party in power in Kolkata and in Delhi, it's good for the relationship, because in the past, there have been many initiatives in the India-Bangladesh relationship which could not fructify.
Like which ones?
Well, water sharing.
But what happens to that now? There's a lot being talked about. Does anything change?
What can change is that you may have a more cooperative state government. After all, there were initiatives taken on waters, because remember, at least two of the rivers, if not, there are many more, which actually flow through Ganga and the Tista. And the land boundary agreement, the maritime boundary, illegal migration, land borders, trade over land routes, all of these primarily, predominantly, go pass through West Bengal. So there were big issues and not so big issues which were used by the previous government in West Bengal to sabotage or stymie efforts by Delhi to improve relations with Bangladesh. On the waters, the simple point is, yes, there is the politics of the previous government, of the TMC and even to some extent the communists. But, you know, the water sharing issue depends on whether you have water or not. You can't create water out of nowhere. So if the water flows are at a certain level, or there is showing a certain trend of decrease of shares or of the water flows, you have to share only what you have. You can't share what you don't have. So that's a separate debate.
The Bangladeshis also now are requesting the Chinese to help them with some dams across the border. That's what the reports are suggesting. Is that a problematic development for India?
Yeah, they've been talking about this Teesta Barrage project with the Chinese. The current government and the Hasina government also was talking to the Chinese about this. I mean, it's actually a little, you know, strange that here you have a river you share with India and you're asking China to help you with the barrage. So I don't know what the Bangladeshis are thinking, but they're not earning any brownie points in Delhi, especially when they are in the middle or they will be entering a stage of negotiation of the sharing of these waters. Chinese presence in some of these projects which are of a strategic nature, and obviously water is for Bangladesh, is a problem.
All right. Thank you very much, Ambassador Pankaj Saran, for your time.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.